Welcome to episode 261 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
There will be links with more information available on the show page today, which you can find by visiting thelabwithbrad.com.
Do we need to cue a saxophone?
Did you hear how I just went straight ahead and just gave it straight?
Straight ahead. Straight
past midnight. This is your idea. it's changing though, right? This is the only week this is going to happen. Yes. Get up in the middle of the night and do this.
Thank goodness.
Because I listened to Monday's track and I sound like I'm drunk.
the week before, I woke up and then rolled over and got on the microphone. It was either me or you.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks.
But I didn't touch anything stronger than coffee, I swear. Apparently, I should have.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about sex and gender and reproduction today. Parental discretion is advised.
And I did already mention the saxophone, so.
I don't get the... Oh, wait. I just got it. All right. Sexy music.
Good morning.
Anyway, we finished our track on Monday, and we went outside, and we were listening to the night, and there were frogs singing.
Oh, yeah.
It occurred to me at the time, and I even said to you, there's a lot of things in nature where two different diametrically opposed forces are involved, pressures on a species, like frogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Those frogs are croaking their little hearts out.
Oh, come on over.
In order to try and find a mate.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't want to croak. Be eaten.
Come on over, female frogs only. Please.
Because they are delicious and made of froggy goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time when they're doing that, they're also attracting rival males, and some species will fight to the death.
Oh, I didn't know.
Be loud and, on the other hand, be able to shut up on cue.
I believe my idea was that's why they croak at night.
Right. Yes.
Less.
Not none, but less.
Yeah, predators out there.
Anyway, we kind of just started this. This is the part where I do some sort of elegant segue into Monday.
Mm.
I lied last episode.
Did you?
Last couple. I lied.
You are a liar.
I didn't mean to lie. It just sort of happened. chromosomes are attached by the centromere to a sister chromosome, a copy of themselves.
Right, right.
Not the homologous partner you got from the other parent.
Huh? Oh. Okay, well that... Okay, that shakes up my image of things, but
yes, it does.
So be it.
Mine too. Actually, I blame the one YouTuber who got it wrong so that I could then put out a podcast and get it wrong. And we could then, innocent children across the land. By the way, this episode is about sex and reproduction and inheritance and that sort of thing. And while we can tiptoe around the subject, I do think there should be some parental discretion here.
Oh, okay.
What was the other lie? The other lie was we had...
There's more and more. I am a liar. Okay.
The other one was that we had a choice between noon and 1 in the morning.
Right.
Midnight, actually, a little earlier. I think what we've done so far is that we've traded a very tired co-host for a very tired host.
I was about to ask, yes. Because, again, I'm raring to go. How you feeling? Well, crap.
Indeed. I finally looked at meiosis.
Osis? Meiosis.
Okay. Meiosis with no T. Mitosis is the process of cell division.
Mm-hmm.
Means that whatever genetics you started with, both daughter cells will probably have.
Okay, yeah.
Barring something going wrong or some weird kind of... cell like the red blood cell that doesn't have a nucleus or any DNA.
Oh, crazy and scary. And yes.
Yes, yes. Meiosis.
Uh-huh.
See?
Yeah. Easily confused. Yeah.
Is a weird process where it splits in two and then weirdness happens and then it splits in two again. You end up with four daughter cells, each of which has half of the original. Help me out here. The genetic information.
Yeah, okay. All
right. Midnight.
This is where 23andMe actually makes sense.
Right.
Yes.
Because you actually have 46 chromosomes. Mm-hmm. One copy of each from your parents. This actually threw me off earlier.
Okay.
First off, I didn't realize that, you know, 46 chromosomes meant 46 different molecules of DNA as opposed to one strung together.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
But then I'm reading about how you get these chromosomes from your mommy and these from your daddy. And I'm like, okay, that's inheritance. It seems awfully modular.
Yeah.
You compare that to some of the experiments I've been doing with digital organisms where you take a strand of DNA and chop it in half and take half from mommy and half from daddy on the same strand.
Right.
Or string. The nomenclature gets so confusing.
I mean, especially because on your side, we're kind of making it up, right?
And there ain't no double phosphate backbone twisty corkscrew ladder-ness.
Yeah. Do whatever we want. Or whatever you want.
Yeah, but I, like, doing those experiments, I had that level of recombination going, and I didn't see that in our cells in our system. Mm. And I'm like, what the hey? Yeah. But I guess that happens during meiosis.
Oh,
yeah. I guess you knew this. You took Bio 101.
Sort of, kind of,
which
yeah.
is what I never did. I've been learning this as a self-taught idiot. with big gaping holes in my knowledge base. Well, there's one thing I've learned by doing the show, it's just how dumb I am.
Everything's disappointing. It's got its own language.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
Centromere.
Just trying to wade through actual academic papers and understand what the heck they're up to.
Yes, welcome to my sad little world. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
lots of recombination.
Cells that have all the two copies of each chromosome, those are diploid.
Okay, yes.
Ones that only have half the information and one set of chromosomes, those are haploid.
Aha.
Now, in my mind, again, oddness, let me get this in here before I forget. Chromosome crossover.
Okay.
Which means that your chromosome from dad and your chromosome from mom start inserting DNA into each other.
Okay, gotcha.
And then they split in half and you get half the chromosomes in each new daughter cell.
Right.
So in addition to having four cells with half the information, haploid, they are each genetically distinct.
From each other, yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting to me that, like, the mixing of my grandparents' DNA didn't happen until my parents were making gametes. Yes, I know the whole process. The whole process I find kind of scientifically icky.
Are you sure it's not just me? I'm just adding some creepiness onto this.
Yeah, that giggle helped.
Recombination. Sorry.
Again, consult the internet for examples. Mm-hmm. Assuming you're allowed to view such images in your country, state, or province.
Right.
But it turns out there are haploid organisms. Bees. Ants, wasps, sawflies, apparently. They do this particular method of gendered specification.
Okay.
Now, humans, we use that whole XY chromosome thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, we'll talk a little bit more on Wednesday.
Are we supposed to pause now?
No. We didn't get this Russian doll situation where we insert each day inside each day.
Oh, so many beeps.
Anyway, so the male is haploid.
Right.
The gender determination is a fertilized egg will produce a diploid female.
Mm-hmm.
A non-fertilized egg will produce a haploid male.
They're only up to one thing. They don't need all this business.
Oh, yeah. A side effect of this, by the way, is that those worker bees, those sisters in that colony or hive or nest or whichever one of those, have more genetically in common with each other than they will have with their children if they were to end up being the new queen and breed.
Right. Wait. Do they breed amongst hives on purpose, or is there a chance they breed amongst themselves?
That's an interesting question.
Glad to have asked
it. I was just reading a paper on a inbred wasp colony.
Oh, yeah.
Where siblings end up breeding all the time, and they occasionally do get diploid males.
Oh.
who are usually physically incapable of mating.
I don't know what to do with myself.
Or sterile, or their children will be sterile. As far as genetic diversity goes, there's an advantage to diploid males because they make genetically variable gametes. Haploid males, their gametes are all the same all the time.
Oh.
So, you know, yay for them in consistency. Yeah. But I've been reading on inbreeding versus outcrossing.
Oh, that's what it's called.
Yeah, okay. I always thought inbreeding was bad across the board, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because recessives come back up.
Right, right. Yeah,
you've got a high probability of getting exactly the same gene in both chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
So things that weren't getting expressed start getting expressed. And generally speaking, most of those recessives are recessive for good reasons.
Yeah. Things that were buried for generations.
But there's a twist to this story. I'd really love a better reference than my vague memory of a documentary I saw a piece of years ago.
Hell no.
But there was this documentary I saw a piece of years ago.
Wait, here we go.
That I vaguely remember. And it was about a population of elephants, or a particular elephant that was ridiculously huge, even for elephants.
Ooh, okay.
And had a couple of other sort of throwback features.
So an elephant has elephantitis?
Did you ever Google? Shut down the internet. Okay. The commentator was talking about how poachers hunting elephants. Most of them don't actually have an elephant gun or the kind of ordnance that can take down an elephant quickly.
Oh.
What they do is they shoot it.
Over and over again?
No, just once.
Okay.
Bullets are expensive.
Yeah.
And then follow it around until it dies.
Oh.
Now, the poor elephant is going to die of infection. It is actually a horrible, cruel, lingering, painful way to die.
Yeah, holy crap. We're better to cows.
But this, actually, we are. Yeah.
Bang your belt. Yeah.
But this particular elephant was much larger than normal and much more aggressive.
Mm.
And they figure it was a throwback. The population had been driven to a small level in the local area, thanks to poachers.
Uh-huh.
You made your bed, now sleep in it. And they wouldn't go near this elephant because it was too big and too aggressive. And none of their weapons would actually slow it down in the least.
Gotcha.
So as far as that goes, it was working.
Well, it's almost like a plan, like... Yeah, a small population. Small,
stressed population. You know what? We got to try some of our old tricks. This stuff isn't working. Okay, now we do this elegant segue.
Back. Elegance.
Out.
We're all about elegance.
Monday. But the elephants and inbreeding and a possible mechanism to try old tricks when your population is in trouble. There are other critters that inbreed a lot. There's a yeast.
Oh, right.
We also talked about this on Monday night off mic because at the time, all I knew about it was from Wikipedia. I had to look up more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wikipedia is, I mean, they're trying to be a source.
They're a great place to start. Props to them, but you do want to double check things.
Oh, yeah.
These yeast have a weird, it's a multi-gender approach to breeding.
Which was baffling to me. I didn't think of yeast and sex together.
Or single-celled critters and sex together at all.
Yeah.
Right? But eukaryotes, single-celled eukaryotes, mm-hmm. can and do mate.
It's just wild. I had no idea.
Yes, in the wild. So they got this neutral, not gender version of themselves. They're running around. They're all diploid.
Mm-hmm.
And they just divide by mitosis and live their little yeasty lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally something stressful happens.
Okay.
And then they will form into two sort of pseudo genders.
Ooh.
And they're both labeled with a fancy letter A. So there's like A and alpha. Oh. I didn't name these things. What can I say? And an A must find an alpha and an alpha must find an A in order to make themselves from haploid back into diploid bliss.
Gotcha. I'm glad you didn't name them because I have complaints.
Once they get to the haploid stage, they can still divide by mitosis, and they will.
Mm-hmm.
And they will actually alternate between both sort of pseudo-genders.
Oh.
So even when there's no other yeast around, they go to the haploid stage, and it doesn't take long before both pseudo-genders are available.
Mm-hmm.
And they mate, and go back to their diploid stage, which implies a lot of inbreeding. Uh-huh. And why? The theory is that this is a mechanism to repair damage to their DNA.
Oh, okay. Stressful.
In our system,
yeah.
There's two times that you get DNA crossing over from one chromosome to another.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them is when, you know, we're making our gametes.
Uh-huh.
The other is when we're repairing DNA damage.
Really?
Yes. Although, this is funny. Instead of crossing back and forth between, say, mom's chromosome and dad's copy of that same chromosome,
mm-hmm.
we're crossing back and forth between the two joined copies of the one chromosome.
It's like the sister
chromosome. Yeah, exactly,
totally
what it
makes
is.
Sense. Now that I know that it actually happens at all,
it's an interesting mechanism. Like when you're learning about chromosomal crossover, uh-huh. right? Homologous crossover. There's names. Hey, and Alpha.
Yeah, I don't like these names. Okay, anyways.
When you're learning about this, you find out that the first thing that happens in the whole step is that there's this enzyme that goes over and breaks the DNA.
Oh yeah.
And then all the mechanisms involved in repairing it happen.
And then it self repairs.
What it does first is it resections.
Okay.
It goes from the broken end and goes, this seems like a good place to stop. And it goes off the back of the other end. This seems like a good place to stop.
Okay.
And then it goes over to the other chromosome,
mm-hmm.
and searches around for sequences roughly the same as the ones they're dealing with.
Okay.
And then they take the one strand is taken from the one spot and put back to repair the damage.
Okay.
And or cause, you know, variety in your gametes.
Oh.
The search mechanism must be amazing. Right? I mean, we've seen the final step be, let's just straight up match base pairs here, right? Yeah. This sequence. But DNA is huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's loops and loops and loops and loops.
And it's not
your chromosomes are never entirely unfurled. There isn't room. It's just a few loops now and again to do whatever it needs doing.
And we're talking about small bits like proteins and enzymes. I mean, it's not like they have much brain power.
Anyway, they were genetically analyzing some populations of yeast, and they found that there seems to be more breeding than they originally thought as an outcross breeding.
Okay.
And this is one of those two different directions. On the one hand, you want to find a mate that is your same species and mm-hmm. somewhat like you. But on the other hand, you want to find one that's a little different than you are and maybe know some tricks you don't. So they were kind of wondering, where are yeast breeding when they're out there in the wild? And the candidate solution mm-hmm. is the guts of insects.
Talk about stressful. Now, where do I live?
This is great for single-celled critters because they're like cruise ships. They're like singles cruise ships.
I only got one day to live, and I'm not spending it here.
Yeah. So they keep going from one place to another where these yeast can survive
mm-hmm.
and picking up strains that can then mate. And they've even seen some hybrids happen between two different unrelated strains of yeast, which is a problem for those yeast because that most hybrids under those circumstances, you get something sterile. Yeah. It's like a mule, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you got that problem too. You know, there's something different, but not too different.
Mm-hmm.
There's a critter called the periodical cicada.
Ooh.
Oh, who has developed an interesting trick to avoid accidentally forming hybrids, wasting all that energy on making children that can't make children.
Right?
They emerge in a set time, and it's years.
Years.
For example, in one area, you may have one brood that is the 13-year periodical cicada.
Yeah.
And another that is the 17-year periodical cicada.
Those are both primes, aren't they?
They are both primes. And the reason why it ends up being prime numbers is because they won't match up except for 13 times 17 every 221 years.
That's a good breathing
room. That's pretty room. Yeah, you got a little wiggle room there. Yeah,
yeah. You said it. That's never mind what I said.
And they spend those 13 to 17 years or whatever as little bitty wormy thingies sucking on tree roots.
Go suck on a tree root.
They overwhelm the predators.
Oh.
This seems to be another benefit for having, say, a 17-year life cycle. A lot of their predators don't even live that long.
Yeah, they're like, what is this? What is happening right now?
So they can't really sync themselves up to your to when your broods emerge, like they do with, say, coral.
Right, right.
Coral reefs, which every single year, during the same time of year, on a flipping full moon, all dump their gametes into the water at once. And you betcha that all the things that could possibly eat the gametes and all the things that could possibly eat the things that eat the gametes gather every year.
It was a bloodbath. Except kind of milky. Oh.
For the bounteous feast. So the coral actually have to put a lot more energy into pumping out gametes than, say, cicadas do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here's a question for you.
Okay.
Why have males?
Well, why not? I got nothing.
Because they never produce children.
Oh.
If the goal is to make as many children as you can, it's far better to be asexual.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're after genetic variety, it's far better to be a hermaphrodite.
Oh, how does that? Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Worms, right? Yeah.
Yes. And in addition, you have to go through all the trouble to find a compatible mate.
Troubles.
Yes. Yeah, A needs alpha, alpha needs A, male needs female, female needs male, or there's no children. And that's the end of you and your species.
Well, I don't know. Why the heck have males then?
I don't know. I only have the question. This is evolution, so one of the answers might be because it happened that way and worked out well enough. But here's an extreme example. The anglerfish.
Okay.
Now, there are several different species of these. They're known for having a spike that hangs over their head with a little fleshy thing on the end of it.
Yeah.
Which they use as a lure to capture prey.
I love those things.
A lot of the deep sea versions actually have symbiotic bacteria living in the little flappy thing to make it glow.
Okay. I guess those ones in particular I like. And they're really ugly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all mouth.
It turns out they're also all female.
Oh, those, that's right.
At least one particular, or several species. Researchers kept finding nothing but adult females. They're not finding any males, yeah, juvenile or adult. But they are finding this funny kind of parasitic lump on the females.
That's right.
Which turns out to be the males.
What a life.
When the male, who is much smaller than the female, finds the female.
Hey,
and
how's it
going? Seems to be specialized for doing that and almost nothing else. There's an incredibly strong sense of smell for females and almost nothing else.
Okay.
But they find the female and they bite onto her belly.
There we go.
And sink their fangs in and start drinking blood.
Over here.
Now, before you feel too sorry for the female, the next thing that happens is that the male turns vestigial.
What?
The skin around its head grows into the skin of the female's belly. The jaws disappear, the eyes disappear, the brains disappear, most of the internal organs disappear. And is nursed entirely by the female's blood. Yeah. And it ends up just being a sack of male gametes and a delivery system.
Is that death? I mean,
I guess I made it.
Don't need this brain anymore.
And then we have the other extreme, when males are not valued especially. Sometimes they are only a meal.
Oh, are we talking about the praying mantis?
We are talking about the praying mantis,
yes,
whose female often bites off the head just before or even during copulation.
This is just going to get in the way. Now,
there's all sorts of, there's a myth floating around, or I don't even know what to call it, a factoid floating around that some species can't mate until the head is taken off. I'm not sure I buy it. I have yet to find a reputable source about that. The idea being that there's some nerve center in the head that inhibits the mating reflex.
Yeah, I mean, I could sit here and make up reasons why either or is true. But
exactly. But the body knows how to mate without the head, which is not that unusual in insects. Cockroaches, for example, you can take their head off, and their behavior remains fairly normal, except, you know, they can't eat and will eventually starve to death. But so them and various spiders and a whole lot of different species in the insect worm, which is kinky, eat the males.
Yeah. Well.
Sometimes as a matter of course, sometimes occasionally.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what spiders they were, but the spider, the male spider, was very careful about this whole mating process. Because, yes, if he screws it up, he's food. But not every time, yeah.
Yeah, that brings us into the very careful sort of tricks the males have come up with to not get eaten, at least until after they've done the deed.
That seems like a large subject.
Yes, it is. In fact, it's communication.
Oh.
Which is an interesting subject in and of itself, especially when you look at something like these yeast cells.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? How do they know when things are in trouble and they should go to mating? How does an A find an alpha and vice versa?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's called cellular signaling, which we'll talk about next time. See you then.
Bye.